difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
You believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome to The Next Picture Show, a movie of the week podcast devoted to a classic film and how it shaped our thoughts on a recent release. I'm Keith Phipps, here with
Josh Robinson,
Scott Tobias,
and behind the boards is Genevieve Kosky. Here on The Next Picture Show, we believe that no film exists in a vacuum and that all culture is more interesting in context. So every other week, we get together to talk over a classic film and consider how it relates to a current movie. This week, while no films exist in a vacuum, some films do take place in a vacuum. We're going to look at two such films, and if we make it back alive, discuss them. Tasha, what do we have lined up?
Ridley Scott's space horror movie Alien arrived in theaters in May of 1979, and it's inspired a wide array of sequels, prequels, spin-offs, and knockoffs, including the new Life, which has come in for some pointed Alien comparisons. But for this episode, we're going back to the source, to the first film that reminded viewers that in space, no one could hear them scream. Alien arrived as part of a wave of demand for all things science fiction, started by the twin successes of Star Wars and Close Encounters of the Third Kind. What type of science fiction films mattered less than the genre. Hence everything from The Cat from Outer Space to a remake of Invasion of the Body Snatchers to the sublimely silly Star Wars ripoff Star Crash making their way to theaters. Alien arrived as a viable hybrid, marrying hard science fiction trappings to an old-fashioned monster-in-the-dark horror movie. The new movie Life, directed by Daniel Espinosa, attempts a similar marriage, throwing in some of the cutting-edge cinematography and zero-gravity simulating wirework recently seen in Alfonso Cuarón's Gravity. Keith, do the Life characters have any easier time of it than the unfortunate crew of Aliens Nostromo?
You'll have to keep listening to find out. Spoiler alert, not really. Please join us after the break.
Some of you may have figured out we're not home yet. We're only halfway there.
What?
Mother's interrupted the course of our journey.
What?
Yeah.
She's programmed to do that should certain conditions arise. They have.
Like what?
Seems she has intercepted a transmission of unknown origin. She got us up to check it out.
A transmission? Out here?
Yeah.
What kind of a transmission?
Acoustical beacon. It repeats at intervals of 12 seconds.
SOS.
I don't know.
Human.
Unknown.
So what?
We are obligated under Section
3. I hate to bring this up, but this is a commercial ship, not a rescue ship.
Right.
And it's not my contract to do this kind of duty. And what about the money? If you want to give me some money to do, I'd be happy to, watch. Let's go with a bonus situation. We have never
talked about the bonus situation. Sorry, can I say something?
Let's talk about the bonus situation.
There is a clause in the contract which specifically states any systematized transmission indicating a possible intelligent origin must be investigated.
I don't want to hear it.
We don't know that it's intelligent.
I want to go home and party.
Parker, will you just listen to the man?
On penalty of total forfeiture of shares.
Money. Consider, for a moment, the first scenes of Alien. After a moody opening credit sequence that slowly reveals the film's title, we watch as the crew of the Nostromo wakes up from a period in hypersleep. After coming to and shaking off the effects of artificial hibernation, they're mostly annoyed. Instead of being close to home, they discover they're way off course, having been summoned by a distress signal to an unknown planet. In short, it's a bummer. Their long, tedious trip through the cosmos is going to take that much longer and involve that much more busy work. Even before the killing starts, nobody on the Nostromo is having much fun. Space travel, in other words, kind of sucks. That Alien begins with the tension already at a low simmer is just one of its many brilliant touches. The crew bickers over bonuses and generally behaves like reality show contestants who've been informed they're going to have to stick together for at least another season. Everybody here is just trying to make a buck doing their jobs. Well, almost everybody. Well, certainly the eponymous alien that does the killing, it's corporate greed that signs the death notice for the crew. They end up playing host to an ill-tempered, acid-blooded guest because the company they work for values the discovery of a new life form over its employees' lives. Those cynical undertones bear the stamp of Dan O'Bannon, who co-wrote the original script with Ronald Shusetz, drawing from ideas that O'Bannon had tossed around after scripting John Carpenter's debut film, Dark Star, a black comedy that took a similarly jaundiced view of galactic travel. And while Ridley Scott, who made Alien as his second feature, rightfully deserves a lot of credit for its success, it's a film where the removal of one creative contributor would have changed everything. Running with the idea of dropping a terrifying alien into a dull, oppressive environment, O'Bannon picked up key collaborators as he drifted into and out of Alejandro Jodorowsky's failed adaptation of Dune. It's there he met artists like Chris Foss, Mobius, and H.R. Giger, the latter most designing the film's unforgettable villain. The oozing, toothy, preopic design does a lot of the thematic heavy lifting for the film and helps drive the horror home. Because even in the dreary, sterile world of the ship, the red and tooth and claw elements of nature find a way to introduce chaos. The dull corridors and living quarters are suddenly host to a creature made of dangerous and unabashedly sexual components, driven by the single-minded desire to survive and reproduce. In the end, no quarantine procedure can keep the horrors of the universe at a safe remove.
What's it got down his throat?
I would suggest it's feeding him oxygen.
Paralyzes him, puts him in a coma. And keeps him alive. Now, what the hell is that? Well, we gotta get it off him.
Just a minute. I mean, let's not be too hasty. We don't know anything about it. Now, we're assuming it's feeding him oxygen. If we remove it, could kill him.
I won't even take that chance. Just cut it off and then.
You take responsibility?
Yes, I'll just take the responsibility. Get him out of
it. So, guys, Alien. Here's the deal. I see this movie. This is a movie I've rewatched frequently. A lot of us saw it together last year in the theater, which was awesome. And every time, it scares me. Like, I know exactly what's going to happen in every moment of this film, and yet every time it gets me. I think maybe this time Harry Dean Stanton, you know, will look the other way or something and safely get away. And he never does. But no. Does anyone else have the same effect on anybody else? And if so, why?
Yeah. I mean, that specific scene with Harry Dean Stanton gets me every time. And I think there are a couple of reasons for that. One is just related to the general design of the film itself, which is, you know, the alien birth doesn't happen until an hour into the movie. Mm-hmm. Then it's maybe another 15 minutes or so until they start patrolling around. And in that time, Ridley Scott has already built anticipation and all this sort of unrelieved dread and tension. John Hurt's character is dead at this point, but no one else. And the alien is now sort of roaming free in the ship for the first time. So that's one reason. And then two, the sequence goes on for a really long time, which is very much in the patient spirit of the film. I think we get two jump scares with the cat before the creature even appears. And when it does, it's this immense, fully grown thing, much, much scarier than the little spermy thing that emerges from John Hurt's stomach. And so there's that shock and surprise as well. So I think both of those things, I mean, that specific sequence. But I think there's another scare, and I can't really recall it, that's just a straight up jump scare with the alien later in the film.
Tom scared in the air duct.
Yep, yeah. Tom scared the air duct. It was one of those things where my heart was like somewhere in my like brain, or like I got a headache from being shocked that hard by it. This movie definitely works.
Yeah, I've never had that, Keith. I mean, this movie is such a model for the horror story where everybody gets picked off one by one. So I expect everybody to get picked off one by one. Like, there's never a moment where I think one of them is going to make the right decision and one of them is going to survive. And part of that is because this film is just so beautifully structured around all of like the many turning points where they are offered a choice and they pick the wrong one consistently every single time. Mm-hmm. There's a moment where I think it's Yaphet Kotto says we should just put John Hurt back into the freezer, and he gets overruled on that. There's a moment where Weaver goes to Skerritt and says we shouldn't trust Holm. There's something wrong with him. Skerritt blows her off. There's a moment where they're all just going to go back into the freezers and everything's going to be fine. And Hurt says, no, but I got to go get something to eat first. There's a moment where Weaver says, we shouldn't take off until the cameras are fixed. Like, that's going to come back to bite us in the end. And she gets overruled on that one. Just over and over and over throughout the film, there are all of these opportunities where you see a branch, and if they'd picked the other branch, this whole story would have been hugely different.
I never thought about that way, but it's kind of like that Wim Wenders film Wrong Move, where you spend a whole movie wondering why is it called Wrong Move, and you think about it, you realize at every possible point the protagonist could have made a decision, he made the wrong decision.
This is such a beautiful movie of bad decision making leading to terrible things for me, and it's so beautiful in that way that I'm never surprised by their terrible deaths, because they pick them at every opportunity. And I love that so much. I love the way this film is constructed. But I do think that scene with Harry Dean Stanton in particular it always comes as a surprise to me when it happens, because as Scott says, it stretches out so beautifully. Mm-hmm. That moment where he's like looking up into the dripping water and just letting it run down his face.
That's right.
You can feel so many moments through that, like in a modern horror film where it would have been cut off by him getting killed.
Yeah.
And the pacing of it is so unlike a modern horror film. You can feel just over and over, oh, here's where it comes. And then it just kind of languorously stretches out. It's a beautiful sequence.
And it's probably maybe your eighth time through that you think, why is there a big dripping thing in the middle of a spaceship?
Oh, that too.
That also does not surprise me, because Ridley Scott.
Yeah, sure.
Ridley Scott's favorite thing in the world is stuff hanging in the air, particulate matter.
Particulate matter.
Watch any of his movies, and the air is full of dust or mist or blowing leaves or blowing smoke or blowing something. Like, how anybody breathes in a Ridley Scott movie, I don't know.
A lot of people with hay fever would have an issue with this.
But the movie also has, that scene also has, I think, the quintessential depiction of what a cat is. In any given moment, which is when the cat watches Harry Dean Stanton get killed.
Like,
and like, this cat seems to register, is it going to kill me? No? Okay.
I'm good.
Yep.
We get that nice cat reaction shot, too,
with
the alien kind of setting that up. But
if I remember the notes on that correctly, they actually, like, cornered that cat and then brought in a big dog and just kind of pushed the dog at the cat to get that reaction.
Poor cat.
It's not great. I mean, filming with animals in 1979 is slightly different than these days.
Maybe not Sam Peckinpah bad, but not great.
You know,
but that cat is a part of film history now.
Yeah,
right?
It's
been immortalized.
Keith, you were wondering on social media whatever became of Jonesy.
Yeah,
Alien sequels.
Jones makes an appearance in the Aliens, but then is left behind.
Hey, guys.
As departs.
I have bad news about Jonesy. Yeah.
What?
I have bad news about Jonesy. I don't think Jonesy's alive anymore.
Well, or hasn't been born yet, really, when you think about it.
Oh.
Yeah. Is this a Nine Lives kind of thing, or a vast circle of life?
No, I'm just saying
the cat that played Jones.
The cat that played Jones most likely is not a robot. Yeah.
I mean, by that logic, Sigourney Weaver hasn't been born yet either. So we get really cosmic at this point.
Yeah.
Weren't we talking about people dying rather than people being born?
That's true. We should talk about the lead up to it, because you're right. That slow boil is kind of, it begins like capturing the drudgery of space travel, which is one thing I love about this movie. Just how bored all these people are. There's certain camaraderie among them. They don't outright hate each other, or at least they recognize that if hating each other is not a good tactical maneuver if they're going to survive this. But these are not people who are going to go off and have a drink once Nostromo lands.
You know, see, I don't agree with that. I think there's a lot of like chemistry between everyone. I think
Sigourney Weaver and Tom Skerritt's character have a thing.
Sure.
Well, I think that to me,
not Stanton and Yafet Kotto.
They have a relationship because they work together.
That's true.
These people are all coworkers. Mm-hmm. You know, there are all of these little threads going between them, just like in a real office. You know, the two that work together and have the same job and are both stuck with half shares like each other better than some of the others like each other. But yeah, Weaver and Skerritt's like sexual history was actually a part of an earlier draft of the script.
Was it explicit in the?
Yeah, it was explicit.
It seems I like that it's sort of like it's there if you're looking for it, but it's just kind of all in the eyes.
I'm telling you, that was one collaborator that was not mentioned among the long list of collaborators that brought Alien to life is Walter Hill,
right?
Who was a longtime producer of the series and who, of course, was known for doing that very thing, taking scripts and just removing everything until it became, you know, as bare bones as possible.
Yeah, the script went through a lot of drafts, and the one big addition that Hill and fellow producer David Giler brought in was the Ash subplot with Ian Holmes' character. We'll get to that. But yeah, if you want to look up, there's a bunch of drafts of the script, but the Walter Hill's draft is like its own kind of like beautiful spare poetry. I mean, it's just, it is stripped to the bone. That was the
period at which, you know, Walter Hill was at his absolute peak. You know, that's prime time. Like, I would put that period in his career up with all the other 70s masters, your Coppolas, your Scorsese's, your et cetera's. This is a great group of people coming together to make this movie, and it shows. One thing I will say too about the beginning of the film, we're going to talk about how Alien influenced life. I think you could say that 2001 had a pretty heavy influence on Alien.
Oh yeah,
in a lot of different ways. I mean, just the patience and the pace of it is very similar. The focus on composition and the formal qualities of Alien are so strong. You know, you get a really good sense of the ship, and it doesn't have a horror movie or even a genre movie kind of pace to it. It's elevated in a way that reminded me so much of the Kubrick.
And just the downtime of space travel as well.
Mm-hmm.
That's in there.
Yeah, people dying in Alien never surprises me. The amount of time it takes to get to people dying in Alien always surprises me, really pleasantly. Because I, you know, when I think about Alien, I think about people walking around in these dripping corridors and all of the action sequences, you know, where they're chasing the acid through the corridors, or where they're, you know, running from their lives, or all of the business at the end with Ripley and the alien. I always forget how beautiful that scene is at the beginning when they're first wake up, and like John Hurt coming out of his mm-hmm. pod is like a flower unfolding, like that first arm gesture that he mm-hmm. makes. It's balletic,
and the dissolve, or this juxtaposition.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean that's one of my favorite things in the whole movie is when he's stretching out, and then you get, you know, this dissolve, I guess, mm-hmm. of him continuing to stretch, and it's just to spend that amount of time on that waking up process. It's a really interesting choice and kind of sets this movie apart.
I just gotta say it. Ridley Scott, pretty good director.
Pretty good director.
Not always.
I mean, this is his best movie, in my opinion. But
best movie. This for Blade Runner.
It is. I know it's better.
This one's for me. This is better than Blade Runner.
Yeah. It's the one in the Counselor.
There's a lot going on in Blade Runner that's,
you laugh.
That's really great.
I like the Counselor too.
No, I like the Counselor too.
I think the lows in Blade Runner are lower than. If are there any lows
no,
here?
No
I,
lows.
Alien is, as far as I'm concerned, is pretty much a perfect movie.
Yep, I'm with you. But I think Blade Runner is kind of a perfect movie too.
Really?
Yeah.
All right. Before we get sidetracked on that, can we just go back to how beautiful that sequence is? Because
yeah,
my God,
I did love that sequence.
There's just something so gauzy about it. Like they're coming out of these like we presume chemically induced sleeps, mm-hmm. and without anybody saying. Boy, it sure does take us a long time to wake up from these chemically induced sleeps. You can feel it. You can feel it in the way they move. You can feel it in just Hurt's face where he sits up and his eyes still aren't open and he's not awake. He's like a baby mouse.
Well, and also you get to admire the architecture of those little pods. I mean, you mm-hmm. talked about it being like a flower, that it is that kind of flower shape. And the scene starts in the dark, and then the light comes on it, and there's I guess a blooming that happens. So I guess maybe all that is deliberately evocative of a flower, but that's cinema.
There's also just something amazing about the contrast between there's that space and the med bay where everything is white. There's the strange little pod that Dallas goes and has his communion with Mother in. Mm-hmm. And these are very 2001 spaces. You know, they're glowing and white and pure and pristine and magical. And they feel like things that were actually in 2001. And then you contrast that with the other half of the film where everything is black and high contrast and drippy and textured. You know, the alien ship stuff is all textured like bone. The human ship is all textured like raw metal. But you go back and forth between these pure white spaces and these dingy, drippy, oppressive black spaces mm-hmm. all within the same ship over and over. And it's so disconcerting.
Yeah. And of course, we didn't even mention you mentioned that little pod with Mother. Of course, we were talking about 2001. That's like the most obvious thing, right? Of having this ornery, rebellious operating system on board that's sort of defying the pitiful humans who are trying to control it.
Yeah, and this one gets a flesh of sorts in form of Ash, played by Ian Holm, mm-hmm. who's a stealth robot. I find that character really scary. I think that the attack fight sequence between he and Sigourney Weaver is just so brutal. And the violence done to his robot body, that scene is so uncanny. You know, we'll get to this, but maybe with a lot of sexual elements, where he basically seems to start spurting seminal fluid when they knock his head off. You know, I mean, it's really upsetting that moment.
Even just that contrast, like when he's first hit. And you go back and forth between him with just the little dribble of milky fluid on his head mm-hmm. and her with the little dribble of red blood coming out of her nose.
Right.
And it's just such a brutal contrast, you know, as you're given a moment to sit with the fact that, oh, he's not human.
Yeah, what a stunning reveal that is. What a beautiful, subtle, shocking reveal that is. And also one that you're both unprepared for and that makes absolute sense based on the way he's been behaving the entire time.
He's human enough to pass and human mm-hmm. enough to be kind of an a-hole.
Yeah.
Even to his dying breath, kind of taunting.
I think he's kind of like a scientist a-hole, right?
Right.
That said, this is one of those movies that it's a shocking and incredible reveal the first time you see it. And then every subsequent time, you're like, how could I not have realized that? Mm. Every time something shocking happens, the camera finds him in isolation, watching everybody else like a lizard with mm-hmm. like no facial expression and no response except, how am I going to manipulate this situation?
That's a really really good point, because I had the same thought of just like, when we got to the reveal, I thought, oh yeah, they hadn't, this, we didn't know this yet, that he was an android. You know, the Ash character reinforces this idea of corporate and government, you know, agendas being placed above the lives of ordinary people, which I think you said Dan O'Bannon was a little bit sketchy on this subplot.
Yeah, apparently on the Ash thing, that was not.
Was not. But because, I mean, the film is already getting into workers' rights a little bit.
Sure.
And you know, these sort of union workers who are being kicked around. Maybe this was a bridge too far. Maybe this was too much. But to me, it reinforces those ideas really effectively. And of course, Aliens, the sequel, would go back to that as well, both quite effectively.
Well, I mean, the Aliens story is the larger universe, the comic books and such, has just returned over and over and over to that idea. Mm-hmm. Until it's worn really thin. And it kind of it takes a little reminding that it was new and fresh and ugly here. Mm-hmm. Because my biggest problem, like, there's so much potential for stories like within this universe. And so many Aliens related stories have just kind of returned to the idea of the corporation still wants an alien, no matter how many times. It goes wrong. Yeah. Corporation still wants an alien to weaponize. They still don't care about their people. They're still willing to kill them all off over and over and over again. It gets a little tiresome.
Yeah. Though I do credit the sequel for being able to repeat that and make it one of the better elements of that movie.
I want to get into the sequels at some point, but let's focus on one of the characters here, which is Ripley, who's become...
Who?
Ripley.
Mm-hmm. Oh, she's a major
played
character?
Played by Sigourney Weaver.
Oh, okay.
Making this character a woman was apparently a later addition to the film, and she's kind of become the word I don't like because it's overused, but the iconic tough heroine. I'm looking at Genevieve and staying away from strong female characters as I say this, but how much difference does this make, and what do you see as her legacy? What did Ripley give us?
I mean, it's what she gave us was tremendous. Like, she really was the first kind of kick-ass female hero in science fiction film. What people remember is Aliens and her with the loader and, you know, get away from her. But coming back to this movie, there's so much that happens in this movie where she stands up to the men around her over and over and over, and she's overruled and discarded. And it's this.
She's right.
Yeah, well, she is consistently right. But the dynamic there would be so different if she was another dude. I think they would have had to make her, you know, 4'2" or something to show what the power imbalance is of being the person who is always right and is always dismissed and told to shut up and overlooked.
Rick Moranis could have played.
Wouldn't this have been, I mean, it would have been Spaceballs,
yeah.
Basically.
Yeah, or right, Ghostbusters. I was thinking Ghostbusters, but go ahead.
She is not afraid to look people that she knows and has worked with in the eye and tell them, you know, you're not getting back on the ship. Yeah, it's possible that all three of you are going to die, but I'm willing to make that call. And then she has to live with that decision when Ian Holm overrules her and just lets them back on the ship. I mean, can you imagine?
Yeah.
Can you imagine looking at one of us and saying, all right, I'm just going to make a decision that is going to kill you. And then on top of that, just immediately having it turned around on you, like, no, that's not going to happen. And now we have to continue to sit here and do this podcast. By the way, it's an amazing dynamic.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things I really like about Ripley in this movie is how she doesn't emerge as the main character until a little bit later in the film, until I guess others have died off and she's in command. I mean, the first time we do really get a strong sense of her is that scene where she refuses to let her fellow travelers back on board due to quarantine procedures. And that's an extremely difficult decision to have to make with real people's lives on the line, and obviously a consequential one. You know, and I think as Ripley's authority grows, Ridley Scott starts shooting her more from low angles to kind of emphasize her height and her strength, and we start to see her as a sort of a legitimate power match, I guess, for the alien, which is growing in a more literal sense. Am I wrong? Am I wrong to notice changes in the way she's filmed?
I think that's her.
Or maybe I'm just thinking of the you know, the climax of the film, which is all low angle and she's in skivvies and whatever, and the emphasis is so much on her height and her body and strength and everything like that.
But. Well, that's also there in the writing. I mean, if you follow the script, early on, she's just kind of like one of a number of people. Like, she doesn't really distinguish herself a whole lot early on. She kind of makes jokes with the crew. She kind of fades into the background a little. And more as the film goes on, she's put front and center. She's put front and center in the scene where they're taking off from the planet, even. She's front and center in the scene where they're trying to figure out, you know, how to go through the – well, actually, even before that, when she comes down to check up on Cotto and Stanton, you know, with their repairs, like more and more of the script kind of pushes her to the front and has her making decisions, even decisions that have nothing to do with the alien, decisions that have nothing to do with survival. She's just put in this very leadership position. And you could say the same for Yaphet Kotto. It wasn't until I was doing a week with the Alien Minute podcast that I really started thinking about the fact that, like, in 1979, having a black guy on the ship who is the boss of a white dude and who also bosses Ian Holm around, like, one of the early things you see him do is just walk in a room like, you're in my chair, and kind of shove Ian Holm off of his chair. All of that was kind of radical for a 1979 movie. And having black people in space in a 1979 movie was also just, you know, it wasn't how people thought of science fiction. I mean, point me to the black people in Star Wars.
Yeah, well, or most science fiction features of the day. I mean, you know, was that Richard Pryor that had a joke about Logan's Run, about how the white people didn't see any black people in the future? I think there was something like that.
You know, Star Trek had already happened, and that had kind of given people the idea that maybe the future would be both gender diverse and culturally diverse and ethnically diverse. So, like, this movie didn't invent it, but it was a very unusual thing to see at the time.
And he didn't die right away. He's like third to last, didn't he?
Yeah, it's
true. Or second to last.
You know what else Sigourney Weaver in this movie gives us, though, is she wasn't the first horror movie final girl, but she was kind of the one that codified the idea. I think it's probably the 1-2 hit of Halloween and this that, like, I don't know how much this was influenced by Halloween. I don't know what their relationship was in terms of when they were actually being shot, but I suspect that both of these movies becoming so iconic in terms of the what I've always called the cast attrition thriller possibly just kind of locked it into people's brains.
But, you know, I almost don't – I guess you would classify this as a horror film, but I just don't think of it for some reason when I think about horror films of the era. I always think – I do think about Halloween and then the slasher films that followed, but I don't put Alien on that continuum, maybe because the sci-fi elements are, you know, equally strong. But anyway, that's my own little categorical brain.
I want to talk about sex. It's not really the text of this movie at all. There's no sex in the movie, but sex is so all over the subtext of this movie. I mean, I don't know if it's there without Giger's design. Giger is this strange Swiss artist who came out of the psychedelic movement, the darker corners of the psychedelic movement of the 60s, and started drawing these creatures that are like half machine, half flesh, and like mostly genital looking. And it's so odd that something this particular to this one person's obsessive vision would be in a major film, but here it is, and it's terrifying, and it brings all this like sort of uncomfortable Freudian imagery into it. That is that feeling there without this design of the alien?
I mean, O'Bannon has been very clear about the fact that working on Hodorowski's Dune and seeing Giger's works was what inspired Alien. And once he started thinking in terms of how a story about like an alien that looked like a giant phallus would play out, he came up with the idea. I mean, this film is very expressly built around, and these are O'Bannon's words, built around the horror for men of oral rape and subsequently pregnancy. The whole imagery of the alien's biological function is built around, what is the worst thing I could do to a man? I could rape him and make him pregnant. So, yeah, I mean, sex is all over this thing. And then, you know, you get things like the weird kind of vulval openings that they go into when they're entering the ship. And the alien itself, like a lot of Giger's alien artwork, it's just a giant phallic head with a separate phallus inside of it that shoots out. But then the bodies of these aliens are often just these like lean, muscular, very sexual, like dancer kind of bodies. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the original concept art, they also had breasts, like really prominent, naked, humanoid breasts. So there's this weird ongoing pull between things that are meant to attract you and revolt you. And like that's what Giger's work is.
Sometimes a cigar is just a cigar.
You know what? It's not here, though.
probably not. Though I will admit, I mean, in terms of your saying about elements of attraction and repulsion, it's, you know, a deeply confusing film on a lot of those fronts. But maybe that's some interpretive problem that I'm having.
No, but I think it's more, you know, if you look for a direct analogy here, as this is a movie about sex as so-and-so, as, you know, a one-for-one point for point metaphor is you're not going to find it, but just sort of this uncomfortable sexual undertones to the whole thing. I think that's part of what makes it work.
I mean, this movie starts with a bunch of people who are nearly naked waking up together, and it ends with a woman stripping down to her underwear. There's just like sexual tension and sexual feeling throughout it. And yeah, you're certainly not wrong about Ian Holm being covered in seminal fluid mm-hmm. when he's torn apart.
And everything just kind of oozes and drips. And yeah.
It's a very moist film.
Oh boy. It's moist. Moist is a tough one.
There's sexual tension between Weaver and Scarrett. There's a moment where Cotto makes a pretty leering joke at Veronica Cartwright
right.
about how, you know, they're sitting around the dinner table and he's like, this isn't what I'd like to be eating. Mm-hmm. And she kind of squirms and giggles and blushes and kind of does the, you know, oh, you, I hate this, but I like it kind of thing. I mean, you've got a bunch of people who know each other well in very close quarters together. That's like being in the military or being in a dorm, any other place where you've got a mixed gender group in very tight company. No, those jokes are going
to
happen.
We touched on it earlier. I want to return a little bit to Ash, the android character played by Ian Holm. It's a different movie without it. Just on the most basic level, it gives the crew a traitor in their ranks, which is a terrifying thing to have when you're up against this kind of threat. But beyond that, you get this sort of embodiment of cool corporate logic. I mean, the chilling line of him saying, I admire its purity, referring to the alien. It's quite the character.
What was your special order?
You read it. I thought it was clear.
What was it?
Bring back life form. Priority one. All other priorities rescinded.
And a damn company. What about our lives, you son of a...
I repeat, all other priorities are rescinded.
How do we kill it, Ash? There's got to be a way of killing it. How do we do it?
You can't.
It's bullshit.
You still don't understand what you're dealing with, do you? Perfect organism. Its structural perfection is matched only by its hostility.
You admire it?
I admire its purity. A survivor. Unclouded by conscience, remorse, or delusions of morality.
I cannot imagine the drafts of the movie without him in it, because there are two villains here. There's the Faceless Corporation, which never confronts three, I guess. There's the Faceless Corporation, which is far away and, you know, only influences the story like via remote. There's the alien, which is, you know, an implacable monster with no face. And there's Mother, which also has no face. Ian Holm is the villain in this movie that you can talk to, you know, that they can pour out all of their frustrations and anger on. And it's also the thing with the voice that tells them exactly how much to be afraid. This movie without him, even leaving aside like all of the important narrative things he does, like letting them into the ship and fighting Ripley and giving them information.
He's a collaborator and an enabler mm-hmm. at the same time. He's working for the company. He's bringing the alien on board and protecting it over the humans on the ship. And so, it definitely adds that element of what they don't need. I mean, we never really talked about the fact that this is not, the ship is not all that well equipped for hostiles. It is, they don't have a lot that they can use to combat this one alien. You know, of course, the sequel stepped it up by bringing up space marines to bear on many, many aliens, but just having this one alien in the ship, you know, that's there for mineral ore, they don't have the resources to stop it.
And they're perpetually fighting the previous version of the alien. You know, it's really kind of not until Ripley confronts it in the shuttle that she's actually facing what it is instead of what they think it was that it's already changed from. I mean, the other kind of thing that's going on with Ash is he's the one with the information. Like, he always seems to, even though there's no way he could know, like, what the alien is becoming, what it's turning into, like, mm-hmm. he always has a little more information than they do because he's applying science to the matter and then concealing what he learns.
That's a good point. I mean, nobody really knows what the alien looks like until it, you know, kills them. I mean, they don't have who has an idea until they actually confront the alien in this thing.
Oh man, and you have that sequence with, you know, so much of this is iconic at this point. You know, the face huggers, the eggs opening up, the horror of what these aliens become. You start off with poor John Hurt candling the egg, basically, and seeing that it's like putting a light up to it so it's transparent, and just like, oh my gosh, there's something alive in here. Let's stick our face really close to it.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't know any damn better.
No. But we certainly do, having, well, seen many horror films, but also the sequels, that that's probably not a great idea.
Speaking of sequels, so does this, you know, there's a lot of films that sequels retroactively change how you look at them. This film's had a lot of sequels and spinoffs and one prequel with another on the way, or quasi-prequel or whatever. Does that change the way you look at this movie at all?
I mean, it ends up enhancing my appreciation for it. I mean, Alien stands apart and stands alone in the series because I don't think it could be done again. James Cameron did a very smart thing by turning the franchise from a horror series to an action series. But once you make that change, you can't really go back. It's like, oh, let's go back to a minimalist approach where there's only one alien and they don't have anything to combat it with. I mean, you can't really do that.
Well, so
you
have sort to keep, of tried to with Alien 3.
That's true. Well,
I
mean, but
I will say this. Like I feel like I should revisit them at some point, but I love The Matrix. The Matrix sequels don't do a lot for me. And that's a case where maybe they sort of diminish my appreciation of the original a little bit. But with each one of these, like talking about the original films in the series, adding on Prometheus onto that makes it a little more problematic. But they're each such distinct visions. They're each different sorts of movies. They're very strong ideas of what the alien movie should be from different directors. Prometheus is directed by Ridley Scott. Like I said, that complicates it. But to me, I just feel like that I don't love all of them, but they work together so nicely that one being lesser than the other, contradicting the other, doesn't really interfere with it. And I don't count the Aliens versus Predators film because
that's good.
I never saw the second one. The first one was just dreadful. So
yeah, I think I missed the first one and saw the second one and hated that. So. Yeah,
the sequels were also just made at such long intervals from each other and with such different people and different mm-hmm. budgets that like the technology was changing so much between these films. And one of the things about going back and looking at Alien, like first of all, it stands apart because of the art of it. Like this is practically an art film in some ways. That moment where Ash first attacks Ripley, you know, grabs her and throws her against the wall, and then the camera just kind of takes the time to make like a long circle around the room and come back to him contemplating what his next moves are while she's lying there. Like that's art. It just doesn't feel like an action film. And you know, Aliens is a tremendous, tremendous film, but everything about like the pacing and the mentality and the characters and the aims of it is so different. Like the only thing that is the same is the kind of the design of the aliens and Weaver's presence. So that film doesn't really, I mean, it's like apples and oranges, you know, they both have seeds and that's about all you can say. So the other movies don't diminish Alien for me because they don't factor into it. Like I find them forgettable. They're like bad fanfic. But the original, you know, still stands no matter what other people do with those ideas.
You're lumping Aliens in with bad fanfic?
No. Those two films. I mean, right. Those are incredible bookends for a series that, you know, for some people went on after that, and for me, maybe not so much.
Yeah, well, Alien 3 is probably the movie I like least that I've seen the most. Like every few years, I'll go back and like I should give this another chance. I like David Fincher's other movies, and it just doesn't quite work. And I feel like the Alien Resurrection almost works as like kind of a strange, like, if you gave a Strange, well, kind of is a cult director making a B movie kind of thing. And Prometheus is just the most beautiful looking movie with the dumbest script. I mean, just as smart as the ideas in this one are,
yeah.
Everything in that is so much dumber. So
also, it's confusing. I mean, there's nothing confusing about Alien. Alien, no. you're it's so simple.
It is.
Yeah. And you kind of walk away from that movie with 1,000 questions, and none of them are good questions. They're all, why are you so stupid? Whereas in this movie, you feel so clearly for these people who are trying their absolute best, and they're completely outmatched. At every step, they're up against the unknown.
Well, we face the unknown of the rest of this podcast. So why don't we take a little break, and we'll be right back with some listener feedback on our last two episodes. discussion of Kong Skull Island inspired a variety of responses, both to that film and to the original King Kong. Scott, would you care to share one?
Sure. Keying off our discussion of the difficult racial history of the Kong films, the Reverend Nick Lannon writes, "What did you make of the Western standoff style of shots juxtaposing Samuel Jackson's eyes and nose with Kong's eyes and snout near the end of the film?" He's talking about Skull Island here. Obviously, it's a traditional quote-unquote gunfighter sequence of shots, but surely it must have deeper meaning than that, given Kong film's long history of racial subtext. Are we meant to think that the characters look alike, that they don't? Are the filmmakers admitting that they know about the racial history and trying to undercut it by making the potential comparison of a black man's face to an ape's face so overt? I didn't know what to make of these shots and was thrown out of the movie by them. Any thoughts? Do I remember that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's very memorable toward the end where he's kind of squaring off against him. I don't know. I want to say to give Kong Skull Island a credit for too much subtext is I don't know. I should see this movie again.
Maybe.
I don't know. I didn't really care for it that much. It's just some smart elements to it and I think ultimately kind of a dumb movie, but maybe it knows it. I don't know. I think that shot may have been trying to just throw the racial history of this series out the window and just have Samuel L. Jackson looking badass staring down a giant antagonist, but maybe I'm being a little naive.
I really do think that they were aware of the racial subtext, and that's why they made a point of having a variety of different characters of color in a lot of different roles. So there isn't just – and I think I said this in the podcast itself. There isn't just the one, you know, black guy versus ape confrontation. For me, that shot wasn't about race at all. That shot was about Samuel L. Jackson's character's just completely unflinching devotion to his insane cause, his belief that somehow winning the war against this giant ape represented winning the war that they couldn't win in Vietnam. And the fact that he's willing to single-handedly face this insanely large and terrifying thing while everything around them is on fire. To me, it was about the two of them locking eyes, as Nick says, like gunslingers, and facing each other down without either of them in any way like turning away. I didn't see it as a racial thing at all. I saw it as a preparation for like the big confrontation to come.
Okay. Well, we have at least one more interesting response to Kong, mainly in the form of a picture that a listener sent of her grandfather, who worked on the original Kong, looking at some of the sets involved, which is really cool. You should go check that out. Meanwhile, we're still fielding new feedback on our episode about Get Out, which including one from a listener answering Tasha's request to hear from some non-white liberal elites about the movie.
I like how we can ask for that and then request it, and then it's granted.
It was granted by a listener named Marion Johnson, who writes in, "To answer Tasha's call, I can give you my experience watching Get Out as a black woman married to a white liberal elite who stopped making eye contact with me about 10 minutes into the film. Watching that movie was both a suffocating and a deeply cathartic experience. My in-laws have made countless comments and overtures ranging from clueless microaggressions to overt racism. It's a no-win situation for me since responding firmly will come across as too aggressive and probably incite nothing but more discomfort, while saying nothing and just smiling uncomfortably feels like falling into the sunken place. I can't think of a better expression of how your spirit feels after withstanding well-meaning liberal racism than the sunken place. It's perfect. It's also why I disagree with those of you who said that Lil Rel's comedy was too loose and improvisational compared to the rest of the movie. The counterpoint to the sunken place is the freedom and looseness you feel when you can code switch because you're talking to another black person who gets it. The movie code switches to something looser because that's how we feel, especially after a racially stressful encounter."
That's me. I was the one who made that criticism.
I wouldn't say anything like that.
That's a very good point. Yeah, I really have no retort to that. I think I was trying to. It's such a general complaint that I have about modern comedy that maybe I applied it broadly to Get Out, because the way Marion explains this makes a whole lot of sense.
I mean, I do feel relief whenever the movie switches into comedy mode. For me, it often feels like switching too far because I'm able to breathe again, and there's just too much oxygen in my system after having learned how to live without oxygen for 15 minutes at a time. Mm-hmm. But mostly one of my responses to this letter was, your husband stopped making eye contact with you 10 minutes into the film. What are you doing at this film that you're making eye contact? Why are you not staring in panic fixation?
They're married and they still can't, you know, they still eye on each other all the time. It's nice.
during movies. Nice. No, he needs to step up about the family. He needs to be doing his job to deal with that, because that stuff does not fly.
Maybe she was just like elbowing him, like, see, and like he was just like not looking over.
I don't think we're here to provide counseling for their family, Tasha. They need every family has its own unique dynamics. I think they need to work this out.
Yeah, but I'm fascinated by this letter because I would love to know what kind of conversation they had about it afterward.
Yeah.
And I'm fascinated by other people's experience with this movie in general, because it's just such a it's a movie that cuts straight to the heart of like how you feel about a lot of things, and there's so much internally going on with how different people feel about all of the different things on display here that I'm fascinated by people's emotional responses to this movie. This letter made me so happy. And I would love to hear from more people about how that movie made them feel.
Good letter. We'll talk about Get Out all year. That's fine. Well, it's
going to keep asking. People are going to keep writing.
It's a rich text. Well, as always, we appreciate when our listeners share their thoughts and their recommendations. To reach us, you can leave a short voicemail at 773-234-9730 or email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net. We may feature your response on a future episode or post it on Facebook for discussion. And that's it for this episode of The Next Picture Show. In the second half, we'll look at Life, another movie about space dwellers with contamination issues. Look for that later this week, or better yet, subscribe to The Next Picture Show on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. Follow us at facebook.com/nextpictureshow and follow us on Twitter at @nextpicturepod, so you'll always know when a new episode drops. Until then, we'll be spending a little time with Calvin, who's not as harmless as his name suggests.